Good evening. Thank you for joining us. This is the American Friends Service Committee. This is our monthly program update call, and today we have Caroline Isaacs and Matthew Lowen from our Arizona office. Hi, Caroline.
Hi, Tay. And welcome, everyone. My name is Caroline Isaacs. I'm the program director for the AFSC's Arizona office. And I'd like to start by welcoming all of you on behalf of everyone here at AFSC, and thank you for your support and your interest in our work. The call today is part of a series where we offer our supporters and our donors the chance to learn more about our work by speaking directly with those of us who are on the front line. And for those of you who might be new to AFSC, we are a Quaker organization that has been working since 1917 for a world in which all people can live in peace. And very importantly, we understand that peace requires much more than just the absence of war and violence. When we work for peace, we know we must work for just social and economic conditions that are necessary to sustain peace in the world. So today I have the pleasure of talking with you with my colleague, Matt Lowen, also here in the Arizona office. He's our program coordinator. And we will be talking today about the new report that Matt has written called Lifetime Lockdown, How Isolation Conditions Impact Prisoner Reentry. And this is part of an ongoing project that aims to end long-term solitary confinement in Arizona. So thank you again for joining us, and welcome, Matt.
Hi.
And I think the place to start in this conversation, we have learned, is by defining terms, because we hear a lot of different terms about these conditions in prisons: isolation, lockdown, long-term solitary confinement. Can you help us understand kind of what it is exactly that we're looking at here?
Sure. Thanks for having me. This is a pleasure to be able to speak with you all. So solitary confinement is an administrative practice that happens not just in Arizona but across the country. And the form that it takes is, in Arizona at least, is placing a prisoner in a cell that is about 8 feet by 10 feet. They spend 23 plus hours a day in those conditions. They are not allowed out other than a time for shower and individual recreation time. The individual recreation time is in a 20 by 30 foot cell with no direct sunlight. In order to get there, they are handcuffed, strip searched, and shackled by the staff of the prison, and their cells are often searched while they're away. They usually combine that trip to the rec yard with a shower. However, in practice, oftentimes these things are skipped over, or simply there are excuses that are made. And so when we say 23 plus hours a day in a cell, it actually, the plus is very important. Oftentimes people spend days, if not weeks, without actually leaving their cell, and then ultimately people are spending months and years in these conditions as that is the cell that they're assigned to. It's not a disciplinary action as we've seen perhaps in the movies or on TV. It's that is where they are spending their time. And we call these facilities supermax prisons, and right now there are 2,000 people in Arizona who are in these conditions.
So when you say it's not a disciplinary decision, I think most of us are led to believe that we're talking about the quote-unquote worst of the worst, that these cells are reserved for the most violent and dangerous prisoners. Is that what you're finding in Arizona?
Absolutely not. And that would be the case across the country as well. But it is very common for that to be used, that language, in order to describe the people who are placed in supermax facilities or forms of solitary confinement. So first of all, you're placed in these conditions based on an administrative decision or a classification. And the way that your classification, your internal classification is decided is by a series of scores that get added up. And the way that you can have a higher security classification is by breaking the rules or not following the rules. So one of the largest populations of people that we find in these conditions are mentally ill. And mentally ill prisoners are placed at a higher rate than just in general population in solitary confinement. And this is for a variety of reasons. Partially it's because they're not being treated appropriately in terms of medication and mental health care, and so they act out or they can't follow rules because of their mental illness. And so as a result, their behavior is seen as malingering or intentionally breaking the rules to cause problems, and so they get tickets and eventually find themselves landed in solitary confinement. Not only is solitary confinement absolutely the worst place for somebody who has a mental illness, it these conditions of confinement where people spend months or years also contributes to the creation and new symptoms of solitary confinement. We also have people who are placed in protective segregation in these conditions. So this is sort of ironic, in my opinion, in the sense that people are asking for protection because they've had threats on their lives while they're in prison, and because the way that it works, you're not allowed to be housed with certain people, and that list gets bigger the more that you're threatened, and so inevitably they put you in these conditions of isolation that, of course, it's for your safety, but there are all these studies that show that being in solitary confinement is absolutely not safe. There's higher incidences of suicide, higher incidence of self-harm. There's also violence that happens in these cells, and it's really, really detrimental to people's mental illness. Other people that are placed in these conditions are people who are identified as members of security threat groups or prison gangs, which can sound really scary and in some cases can absolutely be dangerous, but a lot of the people who are identified as being members of these gangs are simply identified based on their race. And so if you're Mexican, you're a part of the Mexican Mafia. If you're white, you're a part of the Aryan Brotherhood. And certainly not every single person in prison is identified as such, but there are many incidences where people are placed in isolation after being identified as a security threat group member when that's completely not true, but it serves the purposes of the prison administration. And then finally, we also have death row, which is certainly not a sympathetic population, at least in the public eye, but ironically, in prison, this population is for the most part well-behaved simply because they're bothering to work on their appeals in court, and so they can't actually... They very rarely get involved in kind of what is described as the political life of prison and any other incidents. They haven't always been held in these facilities, these supermax facilities. The death row population used to be held on other facilities, but it's been a shift, kind of this ongoing shift of more security, quote unquote, is always better. And so the more people that we put in isolation, the safer we will be, is sort of the attitude.
And so most of what you're describing as far as the youth and the conditions and the populations in Supermax in Arizona, all of that was detailed in an earlier report that that we had released entitled Buried Alive in 2007. And so this project, the report that was recently released, is a follow-up to that. So can you say a little bit about how the new project was defined and some of the research that went into this new report?
Sure. So, yes, Buried Alive was really looking at the conditions of confinement and kind of an initial survey of what prisoners in Arizona state prisons were facing in terms of long-term isolation. And then having continued to work on that issue, we became interested in how it was what impacts those conditions have on people, not just while they're in prison, which there's been a great deal of research that demonstrates that, the negative effects of that, but the impacts upon release. So in Arizona, around 96 or 97% of the people who go into prison get out. And many of those people have spent time in some form of isolation in Arizona. And so we were really curious to see if we could do some research. I mean, our suspicion was that this has only negative effects on people, and we wanted to kind of test that out. So we partnered with professor of anthropology here at the University of Arizona, Dr. Burkett Williams, a friend of ours, and she applied for a Senior Soros Justice Fellowship and agreed to work with us and do this research. We called the research project Homecoming, and the way that we structured this research was to have Dr. Williams go to focus both on Maricopa County, which is where Phoenix is, and Pima County, where Tucson is, where our office is. And those are the two major metropolitan centers in Arizona. and find people who had spent time in solitary confinement while they were incarcerated but have now since been released. So the majority of the places where she was most successful finding participants for Project Homecoming was at different walk-in homeless shelters, social service agencies, for people who weren't there on a regular basis, per se, or on a long-term basis, but could just drop in and get some help with services, maybe take a shower, get some clothes out of the bin, or those types of things. And all in all, 44 individuals participated in a series of 3 interviews. Each interview was structured. The first one was, you know, early life. Second one was incarceration and time in prison. And the third one was to look at the future, how the person was perceiving his or her possibilities in the future after, you know, now being out of prison. This was a huge undertaking, and it's exciting that it's kind of come to fruition in the form of this report, and it's also exciting that we're continuing to get more kind of information as Dr. Williams continues to work with the data and the information. It took, I think, probably 2.5 years from the start to just now when it's been published, and we're very, very proud of how it's come together. And I think we're going to probably talk about the findings soon, but just to say that the findings were kind of very shocking in the sense that it was, I mean, we kind of knew what we thought to be the case because of the advocacy that we have done on behalf of prisoners and the contact that we've had over the years of corresponding with prisoners and working on these issues. But it was extremely difficult to hear the firsthand stories of the people who actually were going through the really difficult time of reentering into the community and facing the enormous hurdles that were in their way.
Well, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about those findings?
All right, I will. So the takeaway message from this report, in my mind, is that there's a whole list of ways that prison is already extremely difficult for people and puts barriers in people's lives upon release. What isolation does while you're in prison is it further removes you or further distances you from any form of potential network of support, family, loved ones. So, for instance, if you're in solitary confinement or isolation, you're going to have less time to visit, less opportunities to visit with loved ones, less resources to write letters, less amount of time that you can talk on the phone. When you do get visits, they're going to be shorter and they're going to be more infrequent. They're going to be through plexiglass walls, non-contact visits, so you can't hug your loved ones or your wife or your child or anybody who comes to visit you. So there's a distance that is created there that, of course, makes it that much more difficult when you get out to then rely or seek out the support networks that you might have been able to maintain if you were in a more kind of open setting and able to interact more frequently. And that's really important, too, because there was, on a number of times, we've had people relate stories of how when they were in isolation, they actually would ask their family members to not come visit them because they were ashamed of the impact that it was taking on them, or it wasn't worth it for them to both leave the cell because it was so degrading to have, you know, be strip searched, handcuffed, and shackled every single time, and they didn't want family members to see them in those conditions, or they didn't want their family members to have to go through kind of the security processes that they would have to go to meet them. And this, of course, is all part of kind of the psychological impact of isolation, in that you begin to recede into kind of yourself, and instead of wanting social interaction, you kind of retreat in a way that makes you want to have less and less. And that is something that goes onto the outside as well. And so oftentimes, because of mental illness or just simply because of not being able to follow the rules due to the extreme conditions of isolation, people will max out their time. Maxing out has to do with basically when your sentence is completely full and you can't, the department can't hold you any longer, your time is completely up, you're not getting out on parole or probation or anything, which of course means that you then are leaving straight from isolation and come going back to the streets without any form of state-sanctioned support networks, as minimal as those may be, nonetheless, there's nothing. And so all of those things conflate to the realities that then they face upon walking out the door and being faced with inability to interact socially, inability to have, they didn't have any education programs or drug counseling, anything that you would have normally had if you were on general population, you don't have access to. And so you're less equipped to actually even do things such as find jobs or find a place to live. And really, honestly, the people that got interviewed, they were living in washes. They were living on the edges of the town with a certain amount of intention, and obviously there's a fine line between saying that they chose to live out there and the impact of isolation was kind of causing them to live out there, and so I want to be careful there, but at the same time, their words were that, no, I want to live out there, I would prefer to live out there because I don't have to interact with people nearly as much. And so that, I think, really is what stands out most about this research, that we are, as a practice, isolating people under the name of security and safety, and then returning these prisoners to the community after having done serious harm to them and making it actually, you know, intentionally almost adding extra hurdles in front of them for their ability to reenter and be successful on the outside.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that we so often hear about the challenges for prisoners reentering society, and the conversation is usually focused around things like laws that prevent them from getting food stamps or policies that prevent them from having certain jobs or obtaining housing because they have a felony conviction, these kinds of structural or legal barriers. But really what I hear you saying is that for people who've been held in solitary confinement, there are internal barriers in terms of their the trauma that they experience and the debilitating nature of that experience that just puts up one more hurdle in addition to all of these others.
Exactly. And one of the things, one of the big problems with that is that there are not then kind of the safety net of social services or family networks or friends or even sometimes a community, because sometimes people are returned to communities that they actually are not even from, to rely on and in order to kind of get help for those internal traumas or post-traumatic stress that's experienced. And I think that's another big red flag that this report, Lifetime Lockdown, really demonstrates, is that we need to not only be criticizing, you know, agencies like the Department of Corrections for intentionally doing this to prisoners, but we also need to be working with social service agencies and state policymakers to encourage them to release more funds so that there are more ways for there to be a safety net for people who are coming out. Because, and, you know, ultimately, this is about what we want as a society, right? It's about, do we want people to have the tools that they can then become, you know, productive, positive influences on our community, because people are going to come back from prison, and what we do to people in prison while they're there is going to have long-lasting impacts. And I think that's really what Lifetime Lockdown is pointing to.
So, Matt, you mentioned that one of the recommendations then in the report is to service providers and behavioral health agencies that they do better screening of incoming clients to determine whether they've had this experience and that there be more services provided for prisoners returning. What are some of the other recommendations in the report?
So, some of the other recommendations have to do with step-down programs between the time of isolation and being released. This goes back to the time when I was talking about a maxing out and how people being released directly from isolation. And so what we would like to see is the Department of Corrections or the governor telling the Department of Corrections to implement some form of step-down mandatory policy that people, when a release date comes up, that they will have already been out for at least a year from the isolation cell and have access then to education programs, you know, congregate activities and other such programs that can help re-socialize folks. Other policies that, I mean, ultimately we would like to see the end of isolation, and many of these are intermediary steps in order to do that.
And a big feature of the campaign at present is the fact that while you were busy writing this report about how dangerous long-term solitary confinement is, the governor of Arizona started pushing to build 500 more of these maximum security beds. Is that right? Can you say a little bit about how that factors into the new campaign?
Yes, that's something that's really critical. The fact that at a time when the population of prisoners has been going down for the last 2 years in Arizona and is still predicted to actually go down for another 2 years, and the governor has decided that it's important to build more prison beds, specifically 500 new maximum security prison beds, it's completely misguided and it doesn't make any sense whatsoever, especially because the goal is, well, not the goal, but it'll cost taxpayers $50 million out of our budget when we just had a huge budget crisis in Arizona. And, you know, of course, this reflects the attitude in Arizona where we cut education spending, we cut social services spending, and nothing in our general budget goes up in terms of spending with the exception of corrections. And we currently are spending close to 12% of our general budget on corrections while we're slashing higher education and social services. And the fact that we want to spend $50 million on 500 new maximum security beds is completely out of line and out of touch with even the predictions of the Department of Corrections in terms of the way that the population is going. And so we have joined with the American Civil Liberties Union here of Arizona for an educational and speaking tour around the state. And we just had our first event on Tuesday evening up in the Phoenix area, and it was very successful. We're very excited about this joint endeavor the ACLU of Arizona has together with the National Prison Project of ACLU and a number of different other organizations and law firms sued and is seeking class action status against the Department of Corrections for their complete horrible lack of care and attention to medical and mental health issues in the Department of Corrections. The majority of the cases or the plaintiffs that they have on their case are actually people who are experiencing this lack of care and abuse in isolation units. And that was actually originally what they started to look at and are now, they are broadening it to a class action suit because they've found out that it was a systemic problem. And people who have done other cases like this, other forms of litigation, and so are very much privy to these types of issues, have said that this is one of the worst situations that they've seen in Arizona. And so while it's a terrible tragedy that it's had to get to this point, we're very excited that we're able to partner with the ACLU in educating people about their lawsuit and our report at a time that is perfect for us to be also raising awareness about the plan to spend $50 million on 500 new maximum security prison beds.
So hopefully everybody on the call is as outraged about this as you and I are. So what can they do to get involved in this new campaign?
Well, the easiest thing that people can do is go to our website, which is afsc.org/Tucson, and there's a link there to take you to an online petition asking Governor Brewer to stop with her plans to build these new maximum security beds. And if you do that, you can elect to get more information from both the ACLU and AFSC on future events. There's some information up on our website, both individual stories as well as the report. If people feel like reading the report, that would be great. They can publicize this. They can write letters to the editor. This is an important issue, and even if you're not in Arizona, this is almost every state in the country has solitary confinement units. And, you know, while they may not be as horrendous as they are in Arizona right now, I can tell you that isolation is isolation, and it's going to have a negative impact on everyone. And so I think partnering with other AFSC offices, if you happen to be in different areas on this issue, could be really, really crucial. And the more people that we have talking about it in newspaper articles, op-eds, letters to the editor, that's a really key component to this, especially because so many people have misinformation about solitary confinement and how it's used and if it really actually makes us safer, which it doesn't.
And you mentioned the ACLU and AFSC are making a tour out of this. So where else will you be holding events?
So we'll be speaking in Florence, Arizona, which is the notorious prison town where there's about 8 or 9 different types of prisons or detention facilities. We're going to be speaking there. We're going to be speaking in Tucson here. We're going to have a whole series of events in Tucson, which is where our office is. And we will also be in northern Arizona, both Flagstaff and Prescott. And then we'll probably go back to Phoenix again, because Phoenix is the capital as well as the largest city in the state, and do more events there as well. And this will take us all the way, you know, into October and beyond, very likely.
And all the information about those upcoming dates will also be available on the webpage. So if folks want to check in as we move forward and learn more about upcoming events, that will be posted on that same link that you gave?
Yes, absolutely.
Great. Well, is there anything more? I want to be sure that we have enough time for questions or comments from those who may be on the line before we wrap, so I wanted to make sure to open it up. If not, I have lots more questions for you, or see if there's anything that you really wanted to make sure you've got to say before we do that.
Well, I think it's just important to say that, and this is in relation to the 500 new beds that are being proposed, like, that there's no proof that maximum security beds make Arizona any safer, but there is proof of what they do, and that causes and exacerbates mental illness, links to higher rates of suicide, hinder successful reentry, and currently are really understaffed, which is what the lawsuit is about. And this $50 million was actually slated originally to help people who have kind of lost their homes due to the mortgage crisis. And so it's bitter, horrible irony that our state is choosing to take that away from people who are in real need in order to put people in a situation that's only further going to traumatize them. So this is a really crucial moment for Arizona, I think, in terms of it's the only state that's asking to build more maximum security prison beds. And I think that this is a really important moment for us.
Well, thank you. And with that, I'll just go ahead and open it up to folks on the call to ask any questions that you may have.
Caroline and Matt, this is Tay. Can I ask a question?
Of course.
Matt, you talked a little bit about prisoners being brought back into communities that maybe they weren't even brought up in or not familiar with. Could you explain a little bit more about that? Because I'm not familiar with that. Like, I just automatically assume that when a prisoner leaves prison, they go right back home to where they came from. Is that not the case?
So you are usually, where you are released to usually has to do with where you got arrested. Not everyone gets arrested in the place that they're from. And, you know, some people also have been in and out of prison. In fact, everybody that was interviewed as a part of Project Homecoming had been in prison more than once prior to being interviewed, which means that the instability that we're talking about that they're dealing with upon release this most recent time was probably very likely already present in their lives. And so while I don't know, you know, specific examples of individuals as to why it was that they were in different places, what I do know is that they're simply released into the areas where they were originally arrested. And so that often is not someplace where they have family or where they have people who can help support them. And that's a really, I think, that's actually one of the surprising, I mean, as you said, surprising outcomes of doing this sort of in-depth qualitative research that Dr. Williams did, because I think we probably assumed that that's the case too, but it really does throw the whole idea of coming back to our community or their community it throws it kind of up in the air to like really start thinking about what that means and what we're doing. I mean, that's once again another failure of our system that is placing people into a situation where they're kind of bound to fail. you know, any one of us, even without having been in prison, if we're just like plopped down somewhere where we don't know anyone, that's going to be hard. And we're not faced with like the trauma of isolation or prison or of felony record or all the other, you know, hurdles that are in the way.
And doesn't it also have to do with supervision requirements? I mean, my understanding is that if people are released on what's now called community supervision, which used to be called parole, but where they're overseen by the Department of Corrections, they're only parole officers in the major metropolitan centers, and they don't have POs in the rural areas. So people are released into Tucson or Phoenix, whereas they may have gotten arrested or previously lived in one of the more rural areas of Arizona.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, in the rare case when people do have a family member who's willing to care for them and or let them live in their house, then that can happen. But that wasn't the case with this population of people. They definitely, barely any of the people that we interviewed had any form of familial support anywhere nearby. So it was kind of just out of the question in general.
And that was a real surprise, wasn't it? I mean, I think, you know, we designed this project with Dr. Williams, and if I remember correctly, in the proposal that we submitted, we said, oh, we're going to do focus groups with family members of these prisoners, and, you know, we'll get all this interesting data from the family members, and we were never able to do that because we couldn't find any. That most of the former prisoners that were interviewed said, yeah, I don't have any family. I don't have anybody that you can talk to. They're not talking to me anymore, or they've passed away, or they live in another state. And so, you know, even as jaded as we might be having looked at this issue for so long, as Matt said, there were still things that were surprising to us in this research. You know, another issue akin to that was that we also were really excited about involving the respondents, the people who were interviewed, in our program, thinking, well, this is a great way to get formerly incarcerated people to be involved in our work here at AFSC and help us, you know, educate the public and work on this campaign. And in fact, we quickly realized that the actual people that we're talking about can't, you know, could barely manage you know, talking to Dr. Williams for an hour or so, that they were so socially debilitated and fearful or uncomfortable in group settings that there was just no way that they would be able to participate in that way. And I remember that being kind of a real wake-up call for us as well. Are there any other questions from folks on the call? Well, don't be shy, everybody.
And usually they are.
Yeah.
But our staff are so knowledgeable. Again, they, you know, so much information that you all share and so much that you know. I think it says a lot about the work that you do that people, you know, really get enough when they do call. And I believe and I hope that their next steps are to just do something, go visit the petition, sign it, look for your events, come out and participate and help you all.
We would love that.
Well, I don't have any more questions. Matt, is there anything more you want to let us know?
I feel like I've been talking a lot. I would reiterate what you said, that like there are going to be upcoming activities. I don't know how many people who are listening are in Arizona, but I know that there are other offices throughout the country, AFSC offices, that are working on this issue of isolation and solitary confinement, and I would urge people to get involved with them. Definitely go to our website and sign the petition. Forward that on to people. We need as many voices in that as we can. So far, we've actually been really successful. I think in the first, like, maybe week, we got, like, 2,000 or 3,000 petitions already signed. It's great. And we also have physical postcards that we're taking around and having people sign, and we're going to mail those in to the governor as well.
And, you know, I would add to that I think that the report and the findings in the report, while, you know, the research was conducted in Arizona, the findings really are relevant to the rest of the United States because, as Matt said, almost every state has supermax confinement. And so those impacts, because the conditions are similar across the country, the impacts on people's mental health, their social functioning, and their ability to reintegrate into the community are also going to be found practically anywhere. So I think that the report is relevant to service providers, policymakers, elected officials, throughout the country. So if folks on the call are involved at all in those systems or would like to pass this information along to anyone involved in the correctional system or community programs, I think that there's actually utility for these findings practically everywhere. Any last parting thoughts, anybody? Well, I want to thank you all for joining us again, and thank you, Tay, for setting up the call and administrating everything for us, and thank you, Matt, for sharing your work.
Sure, my pleasure. It was nice to be here. Thank you all.
I appreciate it. I appreciate you all and your work and everyone who joined us.
Thanks again. Have a great day.
Thanks,
you all. You also. Be safe, everyone.
You too. Take care.